We have completed the math, differential geometry that we will need. And we are about to start general relativity, which is to say the dynamics of space-time itself. But before that, let us study the physics of fields that live on space-time. Scalar fields, vector fields, tensor fields, spinor fields. You will find that it's relatively straightforward and easy to define the equations of motion for vector fields, for example, scalar fields. But how do we define the equations of motion for a spinor field? And after all, half of the universe is fermions described with spinor fields, so we should really look into those. But we haven't studied spinors at all yet. So we will have to study how to do parallel transport for spinors. And once we have that, we can do the Dirac equation. All right, so this is going to be about the dynamics of matter fields in space-time. The word matter acquires a different meaning when you talk to cosmologists. Because for cosmologists, matter is everything that is not curvature, everything that is not gravity. So even radiation would count as matter. As for a particle physicist, there would be a distinction between matter and radiation. Basically, the fermions would be considered matter. And everything that you make out of fermions would be considered matter. And then radiation is something different. But for the cosmologist, matter is everything that is not gravity. So what are the equations of motion for matter fields? So we're not talking about the equations of motion of individual particles, geodesics. We'll get much more about geodesics in a while. But now the evolution of fields on space-time. Clearly, what we want is equations of motion that are intrinsic to the manifold itself. Equations of motion that do not refer specifically to any choice of chart, because the physics is independent of coordinate systems that we choose. So that will be the guiding principle in this. And that means that any equation of motion for matter fields must be an equation that involves only tensors and their covariant derivatives, just to make sure that everything is coordinate system independent. There are a lot of particles and therefore a lot of fields out there in nature. There are fields associated to electrons, to quarks, to gluons, pions, photons, W and Z bosons, and so on. Each one of those species of particles, by the way, the odd one out in this is these guys because they are not fundamental, they are composite particles. But for each one of the fundamental particles, there is a fundamental field, which will be quantized to a quantum field. And we need some notation for all those fields. Let us not introduce a different notation for different particles, but just use the same kind of notation for all of them. And what I propose to choose is that we call all those fields psi fields. They might have some contravariant indices and some covariant indices. And down here within a bracket is a label that labels what kind of particle we deal with. So I don't know. If the label is one, we might be dealing with electrons. If it's seven, we might be dealing with photons, and so on. So we just enumerate the species over here. This is not a tensorial index. It's just an index that labels what kind of species of particle we deal with. Now, you may wonder, how about spinors? How about electrons, for example? They don't quite fit that scheme, it would seem, because they have spinor indices. If you remember from the Dirac equation, it has an index which runs from 1 to 4. Dirac spinors have four component vectors, and they are not really contravariant or covariant. But it turns out that even spinors can be expressed in complicated ways, but also using those indices, as we will see later on. I won't go much into it, but I will give you the general idea.
Are the fields quantized?
No, so far they're just classical fields. You could use them, for example, in the path integral to do the quantization. Now we can ask, could we also have some non-tensor kinds of fields, some species of matter that is not tensorial? We know of one example of a field that is not tensorial and that does play a role physically. And that's the field of the connections. It's the Christoffel symbol field. That thing is not tensorial, if you remember, and it still plays a role in physics. So let's ask, what if we had another one of those, another connection field? Let's call it gamma tilde. It behaves just like our ordinary gamma, but it's another one. So what would that mean? Does that mean we have two kinds of gravity? Would that mean we have not just a gravitational force, we have also some tilted gravitational force with all the features that come with that? Well, we could have in the universe another field like that, but it wouldn't mean that we have another gravity. Because it turns out that the difference between a Christoffel symbol and another Christoffel symbol is actually a tensor. Let's check that. So let's say this is a Christoffel symbol field. So it transforms the way that Christoffel symbols do. And that as well is a Christoffel symbol field, another one. It also transforms under coordinate changes the way that Christoffel symbols usually do. And the claim is that the field that you can construct by taking the difference between the two is itself tensorial. It will transform exactly like a tensor would, that is one-fold contravariant and two-fold covariant. If so, and we will prove it in a minute, if so, that means that introducing a second gravity, a second affine connection, is really not introducing a new kind of gravity. It's just introducing a new tensor field. And of course, we can introduce all sorts of tensor fields, assuming that there are experimental reasons for doing so. But the message here is that you don't have two affine connections. It is legal to say we have only one affine connection. Everything else is tensors. So why is it that the difference between two Christoffel symbols is a tensor? Well, let's see. If we take one Christoffel symbol, it's a coordinate transformation. And you see, we find it convenient for the moment to use the physicist's definition of what a tensor is, namely to identify it by its transformation properties. The Christoffel symbols transform this way. Remember, this is the usual tensorial way. But then there was also this homogeneous term. It's called homogeneous because it's not proportional to gamma. Now, let's say we have a second affine connection, gamma tilde. It transforms the same way under change of coordinates. So we have, again, this tensorial piece, and then we have this other inhomogeneous piece. The point being, a homogeneous piece, this is not dependent on gamma. This is not proportional to gamma. So if we take the difference between the two affine connections, we find that, collaborators are busy there. We find that the difference transforms only with the tensorial piece, because that is exactly the same term for both affine connections. So the difference between two affine connections transforms exactly like a tensor. It is a tensor. And there are two implications of this. One I mentioned already. We don't have to worry about there being two gravities that compete with each other, or three or four or 25 different gravities. There's only one affine connection. Everything else just differs from it by a tensor. But also, for later purposes, when we will use the variational principle to derive the equations of motion of gravity, we will have to vary the curvature. We will have to vary the affine connection. And the variation of the affine connection is like a difference between two affine connections, and that is tensorial. So even though gamma is not a tensor, any variation of it, delta gamma, is a tensor. That will be useful later on when we use the variational principle for gravity. Today we will use the variational principle, but not for gravity yet. We will just use it for fields that live on a curved background. So then what are the equations of motion of matter fields once you put them on a curved space-time? We will derive those equations of motion using the action principle. Remember that any theory of matter fields can be defined by specifying the so-called Lagrangian function, which is a scalar function in terms of the fields, usually some polynomial in the fields and its derivatives. And in our case, the Lagrangian function that describes the dynamics of our physical fields, everything except gravity, that the Lagrangian function will be a function, and generally a polynomial, of all our physical fields, so whatever indices they might have, and here we are running through all the species, and also their covariant derivatives. It better depend on the covariant derivatives for the action to be a scalar. Or necessarily depends, of course, on that. So the action is a function of all our matter fields, and in general, we will write it out as L superscript matter, but that includes light, and that Lagrangian will be a function of all of the matter fields and of all of the matter fields and their covariant derivatives. And of course, of the metric. That will come into it as well. After all, we will have to contract indices so that we are ending up with a scalar function. So the metric will be needed in various places. So then we define the action functional. The action functional maps, well, why is it called a functional? Remember, a functional is a map that as input takes a function and as output produces a number. So the action is one of these things. It takes a function as an input and it outputs a number. This psi doesn't carry indices. That's because I'm just omitting all of them. It's really, of course, all of the psi fields for all species. So the action is a scalar function of all the different species of fields and their covariant derivatives. We will allow only first covariant derivatives. And that is not necessarily dictated by the physics of it. But the general assumption is that whatever action needs to be considered, it probably suffices to write it using first derivatives, because in this way, the equations of motion will be at most second derivatives. And that means that for initial conditions, the amplitudes and the derivatives suffice. We don't know of any physical law that would require higher derivatives. Now, if you know an object, if you know of an object where it is and what velocity it has, then you can calculate what its further evolution will be. You don't need to know its initial acceleration. Okay, so in the action, it should suffice to just consider the fields and their first covariant derivatives. For completeness, let me mention that if you've done that, you can always use integration by parts to make second covariant derivatives appear. But the point is, you should be able to write it only in first derivatives. Okay, so that's a scalar function. And here we have the volume form. Remember, the volume form that is induced by the metric is given by the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of g, and we will abbreviate that simply as square root of g, times d4x. That whole thing is an n-form, and when I multiply it with a scalar, it's still an n-form. Technically, this is the wedge product between an n-form and a zero-form, which is the ordinary product. So if you take any arbitrary field configuration of all the different species and you plug it in here, you get a number out of it. the action principle or the action postulate of classical physics is then that in nature, physical fields psi are such that the action S of psi is extremal, or at least stationary, in the space of all fields psi. So not all psi can occur as solutions, but only those that extremize the action S. Of course, you know already that in quantum mechanics, this is generalized. And all psi occur with different probability amplitudes. And then you can do a steepest descent approximation of your path integral. And you find that to lowest order approximation, you get classical physics, which is, again, the statement that the extremal solution is the one that nature realizes. In the path integral, the extremal solution and its immediate neighbors are the ones that contribute most to the path integral. Just because the phase is then stationary, it's not as oscillatory as it would be for other fields. Okay, but here we stick with the classical theory. Mm-hmm. Did I do that yet? Yeah. We will get to that in a moment. It's basically to make sure that certain boundary terms don't contribute. So when we study the variation of the action with respect to fields, we will not vary them everywhere. We will vary them only in a finite region. And that will make sure that we don't have to worry about certain boundary terms, just to keep the variational principle clean. But you will see it in a moment how that arises. You can make that region arbitrarily large. So ultimately, we are not losing out on that. It's just a safety measure. Okay, so the classical action principle says that the physical fields have the property classically occurring physical fields have the property that they extremize the action. So ds by d psi is equal to zero. But what is ds by d psi? How is that defined anyway? Once we know how to define that, we should be able to calculate this, and that will give us the equations of motion for photons, electrons, and whatnot. But how do we do that? What is the definition of the functional derivative? I assume you've all seen functional derivatives, but let's just quickly go through that again, just to make sure. So we need to define this object here, the delta S and the delta psi. What are these? What is a delta psi? So when we vary a field psi, and remember this should really be decorated with indices there and species labels, I'm just dropping that for simplicity. A variation of a field psi, let's spell it out, without the contravariant covariant indices, just the species index, for example. If we want to vary a field in a region B, then this is technically a one-parameter deformation of that field. One moment, let me just close the door. Little kids are very communicative. Okay, so instead of having just a function psi of p, p is the point on the manifold, right? Instead of just having a function psi of p, we now have a function psi of p and lambda, where lambda is a deformation parameter. It runs from a little bit below zero to a little bit above zero. It's just a real parameter. And we choose, in order to get one of those variations of psi, we choose the psi of lambda and p to have the following two properties. If we choose the parameter lambda to be equal to zero, then the psi of zero and p is supposed to be just the original field. We haven't done anything to it. We will also choose the psi of lambda and p to be such that outside a certain region, which is to say for all p that are outside the region B, where we want to vary the field, the deformation should not deform anything. Okay, so inside the region B, the psi of lambda and p could be anything. But outside that region, the lambda doesn't do anything, and we are always having the old field. Only inside the region B are we allowing us to deform it. And the deformation parameter is such that for finite lambda, we get some deformation inside that region B. But for lambda equals zero, we have not deformed. Okay, so if you look at this function, what happens is that if we choose lambda equals zero, we haven't deformed psi at all. If we change lambda to something a little positive or a little negative, then the field psi will change, but only inside the region B. This is the requirement. Then, using a variation of psi parameterized by lambda, we can define the delta of psi to be the derivative of our psi of lambda and p with respect to lambda. So it's the rate of change of the field with respect to the parameter lambda. This is, of course, a zero outside the region B where we allow ourselves to do a variation. Then the action principle is the following. It says that the derivative of the action with respect to the parameter lambda supposed to be equal to zero for all variations of psi that we might consider. So you see, this is now a concrete thing because this is an ordinary derivative here. But you see that this is not just one equation now. This is an equation that must hold for all psi of lambda and p that obey the requirements 1 and 2. All right, let's evaluate that. So we assume that psi is one of those psi of lambda and p, one of those deformations. The equations of motion require that 0 is equal to ds by d lambda, where this is the ordinary partial derivative, where we differentiate s with respect to psi and psi with respect to lambda. So overall, if we spell that out, we get the following terms. Remember that s is the integral over L. Okay, just give you a full picture here. This thing here. So now we are varying s, which is to say we are varying that integral here. As we do the variation, this piece is not changing. Later, when we will do the variation with respect to the shape of the manifold, that piece will also change. But in this case here, everything is only psi dependent. We are only varying the psi. And so we need to only vary that piece here in the integral. Let's do that. Oh, by the way, I didn't explain about that picture here. So here's M is the big manifold, and B is the region in which we do the variation. But B could be any region. Okay, so we evaluate that now. Just spelling this out, we obtain that we have to differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to its dependence on the physical fields psi. And then we do the variation with respect to the physical field psi. So this is, if you remember, this is by definition the d psi by d lambda at lambda equal to zero. And it's just for convenience that we write it this way. And then we also have to differentiate the L with respect to its dependence on the covariant derivatives of the field. Only the first covariant derivative. Because that was an assumption that went into the construction of the action. It will be a function only of the fields and their first covariant derivatives. In fact, it will be a polynomial in the fields and the first covariant derivatives. So we have dl by all of the first covariant derivatives of the physical fields. And then we have to do the variation of the first covariant derivatives of the fields. Let us call these terms of the type, they are all, this whole term is the term one, and this whole thing is term number two. Let us work on term number two now. So remember what it was, dl by the covariant derivatives, and then the variations of the covariant derivatives, which is really the differentiation of the covariant derivatives of the physical fields with respect to lambda. Let's work that out. Here we are using that the variation of a covariant derivative of a physical field is the covariant derivative of the variation of the physical field. So whether we first vary the physical field and then differentiate, or first differentiate and then vary, should not matter. Why is that so? Well, let us look at one point on the manifold. We choose one arbitrary point. We will be able to do that for each point, but let's just choose one point of the manifold and see whether it's true there. To see whether it's true there, let's choose a Riemann normal coordinate system whose origin is that point. In the Riemann normal coordinate system, at the origin, the gamma, the Christoffel symbol vanishes. Remember? At the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, the Christoffel symbol vanishes. Which is to say that the covariant derivative is the ordinary derivative. So at the origin, we simply have the statement here, this statement is that the variation, the statement that the variation commutes with the covariant derivative is the statement that the variation commutes with the partial derivative. But what is a variation anyway? It's a differentiation with respect to lambda. So what this statement is saying is that the derivative with respect to lambda commutes with the derivatives in all spatial directions. So the partial derivatives d by dxi commute with the d by d lambda. And that's just, that's true just because of the assumption that everything we do is smooth. The variation has to be smooth, but also the manifold and the fields are all smooth, and therefore we have a commutativity of all those derivatives. And that's true at every point. So this is true at the origin of every Riemann normal coordinate system, but you can choose every point to be the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, and so it's true everywhere. So for that reason, we can now rewrite the term number two. Term number two was, if you remember, we differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to the first covariant derivatives of the physical field, and then we have to take the first covariant derivatives of the physical field and take their variation. But using this, we were able to write, instead of varying the covariant derivative, we have the covariant derivative of the variation. Right? So it used to be the covariant derivative, which we then vary. But now it, the way I wrote it is we first vary and then do the covariant derivative. Same thing. We can rewrite that in this way by adding and subtracting something. Notice that this covariant derivative, this semicolon E, is acting only on that bracket. In the line below, I've put the bracket not this way, but that way. So now I have the covariant derivative, the semicolon E, acting not just on this, but also on that. I have to undo that, right? By the Leibniz rule, I'm getting two terms. I'm getting the covariant derivative of this, leaving that alone, plus leaving this alone, taking the covariant derivative of that. The second of those terms is what I had here. But there's also a term where I have, if I spell out what this is, there's a term where I covariant to differentiate this, and then just leave that alone. That term is extra now. I have to subtract it. That's what this does. This is the subtraction of that extra term. It's the term where I differentiate this and leave that alone. I have to subtract that term. In this way, I have two terms from here. One of them is canceled by that, And the term that's left over is this one here. Okay, so now let's identify this term here as a vector which has one upper index e. Okay, so we have the covariant derivative here, and all of the other indices are contracted. So we can view this as a contravariant vector. And we have, of this contravariant vector, the upper index e is contracted with the semicolon e over here. This looks like a divergence. Right? If you remember, if you take a vector field, and you take the first component and differentiate it with respect to x1, add to it the second component, differentiate it with respect to x2, etc., add this all up. That's what you would normally, on flat space, call a divergence. Here we have the covariant version of that. We have ke, and the eth component is differentiated in the eth direction, and you sum up all those terms. This is indeed a divergence. And I'm not sure whether I leave it to you as an exercise, or I will explain it in a moment. We'll see. To show you that this is really how we defined, that this agrees with how we defined the divergence earlier. Okay, so, but the point is, this is a vector field, and here we are taking the covariant derivative of it and then contract it all up. And this will turn out to be a divergence, and because it's a divergence, we can use Stokes' theorem, or its special case, the Gauss theorem, and we find out that this is a boundary term. Since we work here with a finite region, we will be able to, outside of which the variation is vanishing, we will be able to drop that boundary term. Okay, so here's that boundary term. We have this vector k, e, semicolon e, and that is an integral over a divergence. Yeah, I left it to you here as an exercise, but I'm afraid I gave you the solution over here. So pretty much the solution. Okay, so then remember that the divergence of a vector field is actually the d of something. The divergence of a vector field is a Lie derivative of the volume form. The Lie derivative is inner derivation after exterior derivation plus exterior derivation after inner derivation. But the volume form is a top form. It's an n form, which means that this term goes away because you have a d on an n form, would be an n plus 1 form, doesn't exist. So you're just left with the d after the inner derivation, just to say that the divergence is the d of the inner derivation of the volume form. Since it's the d of something, we can use Stokes' theorem to turn that d of something into the integral over that thing without the d, and instead we have the boundary operator here, right? Instead of having the co-boundary operator on the form, we can have the boundary operator on the region. And that is what we have here. This is d of the inner derivation on omega. We get rid of the d, and instead we'd have only the inner derivation of omega. And by getting rid of the co-boundary operator over here, we get the boundary operator over there. Okay. However, we chose our variations to be such that they vanish at the boundary and beyond. And this means because our vector k is actually proportional to the variation. Remember, this is the vector k. It is this business here, and it is proportional to the variation of the physical fields. But the variation of the physical fields vanishes by definition, by construction, on the boundary and beyond. So the k vanishes on the boundary and beyond, and therefore this whole thing vanishes on the boundary, and this whole term goes away. So what that means is that this term doesn't contribute after all, and we are only left with this. You may wonder, what have we done here? Is there any analogon? Is there anything you've seen earlier in whenever you calculate equations of motion using the variational principle? Do you recognize what we've done? It's just integrating by part. Okay, just integrating by parts, And this business, all this arguing with Stokes and so on, was just to show that even on curved space, you can throw away the boundary terms. And we did it a little bit more cleanly with the variations. So after all, what we've achieved is that we took this term, number two, and instead of having the covariant derivative on this term, we did an integration by parts, threw away the boundary term, and now we have the covariant differentiation on that first term here, and no longer the covariant differentiation on the physical fields. It's just what you would do in special relativity as well. It's just a bit more involved to do it on curved space too. And why do we want to do that? Why would we want to shift the covariant derivative away from the variations of the field on the other side? Well, it's because later on, in order to read off the equations of motion from the variational principle, we would like to have under the integral stuff and more stuff and more stuff multiplying the variations of psi. So that we can then say, okay, because all variations of psi are allowed, the stuff itself has to vanish, and that gives us the equations of motion. So we don't want to have under the integral covariant derivatives of the variations. We want to have only variations, and in this way we can pull all the collect all the terms together and multiply them with the variations and conclude that all the other terms together have to vanish. Okay, so we're almost there. This term goes away. We did integration by parts. Covariant derivative is now acting on this. And our psi are no longer being covariantly differentiated, no longer differentiated at all. Okay, so we can reap the benefits. This was term one, and I just reproduce it here unchanged. And the term number two, after the integration by parts, acquired a minus sign, and the covariant derivative that was acting on the variations of psi are now acting over here. So we have here the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the physical fields multiplied with the variation of the physical fields. And here we have the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the covariant derivatives of the physical fields, itself covariantly differentiated and multiplied with the variations of the field and not the covariant derivatives. Since, and this was the whole purpose of the integration by parts, since now both of these are just the variations of the physical fields, we can put this and that together and multiply it with this. So we can conclude that this minus that itself must be equal to zero, on the grounds that this equation has to hold for all variations of psi, for all regions B, and so on. So we conclude that the equations of motion that the physical fields will have to obey under the classical action principle are that the L by d psi, this business, minus the L by the covariant derivatives of psi, itself covariantly differentiated, equal to zero. So these are the Euler Lagrange equations. And in principle, they give you all of the equations of motion, be that for the Klein-Gordon equation or electromagnetism, and so on and so on. So here are examples. Let's say we take a real valued scalar field, a Klein-Gordon field. And that field could describe the Higgs particle. It could describe pi zero mesons, which are not fundamental. They are quark anti-quark systems. It could also describe the inflaton field. What Lagrangian should we assume to describe such real valued scalar fields? The general technique for guessing what the correct action is for a physical field in curved spacetime is to choose a Riemann normal coordinate system, so geodesic coordinate system. And then at its origin, we should have approximately special relativity holding. And if we assume that we know what, if we know what the equations of motion are in special relativity, just write them down there and then generalize, make it covariant. So if we do that for a real valued scalar field, we get the Klein-Gordon action. And Klein-Gordon action is, of course, given in this way. It's the spatial and temporal derivatives squared, factor 1/2, which in the, at the origin of Riemann normal coordinate system are just ordinary derivatives, but we know what is an ordinary derivative at the origin of a Riemann-Notman coordinate system is a covariant derivative in any other coordinate system. So we have to use semicolons here, and the regulum and the metric, of course, becomes the GAB, the full metric, and the scalar part is just unchanged. Now, when we apply this Euler Lagrange equation, I leave it to you as a little exercise, to this Lagrangian here, then we obtain that the equation of motion that follows is this one. This is the covariant Klein-Gordon equation. It's just the second covariant derivative of our scalar field as a semicolon AB, and then contracted with the GAB equal to this. This is the same as having the Laplace operator act on it. It's just another way of writing it. We arrived at it from the Euler Lagrange equation point of view. That's why it is more convenient to write it this way, but the Laplacian can also be written as the GAB and then the second covariant derivative on scalars. The Laplacian on scalars takes this form, not necessarily the Laplacian on other tensor valued fields. Please try to verify that. Now, another example, the electromagnetic field. Let's just say we are considering only the electromagnetic field without any charges. We'll get to charges in a moment. So it's just electric fields and magnetic fields. So there are only electromagnetic waves. Then we can define the electromagnetic four potential, which is a number valued one form. I'm saying number valued as opposed to tensor valued, because you remember we also have differential forms that are tensor valued. So this is just a traditional, ordinary one form. And I think I mentioned that earlier, that the in electromagnetism, the electromagnetic four potential is a one form. And when you take its exterior derivative, so the dA, you get a differential two form, two-fold covariant tensor, totally antisymmetric. And that thing it contains the electric and the magnetic fields. If you remember how it looks like, the 4x4 matrix, since it is, if I plot it as a tensor, the 4x4 matrix, and since it's antisymmetric, it's a differential form after all, since it's antisymmetric, it will have zeros on the diagonal. On the off diagonals, it will have in the space-time components the electric field, and in the space-space components the magnetic field. In special relativity, the Lagrangian can be written as the contraction of the a total contraction of the field strength tensor with itself, which of course can be expressed in terms of the A fields as well, in terms of those one form. And I'd leave it to you to write this in terms of the A. Not hard to do, but it's important to do, because once you've written the equations of motion in terms of A, you can then do the variational principle. You can calculate what the Euler Lagrange equations are, and the Euler Lagrange equations for electromagnetism come out to be these. So here we have the field strength tensor, and we have the covariant derivative in each of the directions, and we get here, and we have a contraction between the B and the C indices, and these are what would be the inhomogeneous Maxwell equation. If there were charges and currents around, then they would show up here as a one form. See, once you contract the B's and the C's, but you're just left with one lower index. That's a one form. It's a covariant tensor. So on the right hand side, you can have currents and charges appearing as a one form. Now, we didn't carry around currents and charges, so you just have to trust me on say when I say that this is going to be the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations if you have charges and currents around. And these are the only equations of motion that you get from the Euler-Lagrange equation. Only the inhomogeneous ones. What about the homogeneous ones? Well, the homogeneous Maxwell equations, once you spell them out explicitly and covariantly, can be written in this way. These, the homogeneous Maxwell equations, which would even be zero if there were currents and charges around, these homogeneous Maxwell equations, as I said, do not arise from a variational principle, do not arise from an Euler Lagrange equation. Instead, they are simply this. They are to say that since F is an exact differential form, it's the D of A, so it's exact, it's clear that the D of F is vanishing because it's the D squared case. So that statement is this statement, you spell it out. And we discussed earlier that this is a structural equation, not a dynamical equation per se. Now let's look at a more complicated situation. Let's say we have on our curved space-time electromagnetism. So we have our four-vector field A, or a one-form A, but we also have currents and charges. But to keep things simple, because we haven't dealt with spinners just yet, we haven't done the fields that describe electrons just yet, let us just say we are dealing with a charged scalar field. So let's say we had scalar particles flying around and they carry a charge. They're electrically positive or negative, and so they will create electromagnetic fields, they will be impacted by electromagnetic fields, and so on. How would we describe that? So for example, pions, a pi plus particle or so, that consists of a quark and an antiquark, and they can be scalar and charged. So how would we describe their interaction in an effective way? I mean, in a fundamental way, we would have to describe this as two fields, as two quark fields, and so on. But often, if you don't resolve the individual quarks in the pion, then you might as well treat this as a fundamental particle, even though it's really not. Okay, so what would be the action here of the Lagrangian? Well, the equivalence principle tells us what we have to do in curved space from what we know is right in special relativity. In special relativity, the Lagrangian would have this form, except that the covariant derivatives would be ordinary partial derivatives. So again, with the argument that at the origin of Riemann normal coordinate systems, the ordinary derivatives are the covariant derivatives, we can write this down at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system and then make it covariant by putting the dots on the commas to get the semicolons and covariant derivatives. And if you remember, this is what is called the covariant derivative in electromagnetism. You have the ordinary derivative, plus you have something that is like a Christoffel symbol. And have all of you seen that? Maybe not all of you, but in electromagnetism, there is also an affine connection, but it's not parallel transporting a vector in space. But instead, it's just the internal degree of freedom of electromagnetism that does it. So I don't want to get too much into this, but just to say that a derivative, and then you have some field times the psi, this is formally similar and, in fact, equivalent. It's, again, an affine connection that you have for gauge theories in particle physics. But it doesn't matter for our purposes. Just take it as a given for now that in special relativity, this is how the action looks like. You have the momentum, that would be the ordinary derivative, and you make it the canonical momentum by adding this A field to it in the presence of electromagnetism. And so you have here the P squared of A, really. Right? This is one P, one momentum, ordinary derivative, and here's another momentum, so you have P squared. And the second derivative of the psi field, you make it covariant. You make it the canonical momentum by adding those A's, and you make it covariant by making these things semicolons. So this is describing the kinetic term for your psi field. We also have a mass term for our psi fields, and this is the kinetic term for the electromagnetic field. So this is just the electromagnetic field alone. The terms with just psis and psis are the psi field alone, and then we also have psi A fields, and they couple the electromagnetic field dynamically to the psi field. Maybe just a last comment. Remember that I said that when you have two affine connections, the difference is like a physical field again. And it's basically like that. We have two affine connections by adding this A to it, and the difference is that we have another force in the game. We don't have another gravity, we just have another physical field in the game. In this case, it's electromagnetism. Also, for those of you who are interested in particle physics, notice that the scalar field that we are dealing with now is a complex scalar field. I used a complex scalar field, and that meant that on the left-hand side, we have, you know, the complex conjugated field. On the right-hand side, we have the original fields, so that when we form psi star psi, as for example we do here, we get something real, because the Lagrangian has to be real so that the action gets real. But you may wonder, why did I bother doing that? Why did I write it for a complex field when before we were just happy with a real valued scalar field? The reason is that a real valued scalar field would not couple to electromagnetism. A real valued scalar field is a neutral, is describing neutral particles. And the calculation that shows you that is over here. Let's not go into too much detail. I can just tell you, by the way, you get the mixed term, the interaction terms. Are these terms where you have this times that? Okay, so it's a term with A psi star psi, where the psi is differentiated. And then there's another mixed term that describes the interaction between the A and the psi, and that's this term where you have the psi star here and then the A psi. And if psi is a real valued field, then the two terms cancel each other out, because one comes with a minus sign and the other comes with a plus sign. So there is no interaction term left. A real valued scalar field will not couple to electromagnetism. A complex valued field will couple, because that difference is non-trivial. It's because when you look at this interaction term, you find that the psi star is covariantly differentiated and the psi is not. If you look at this interaction term, you will find that the psi is covariantly differentiated and the psi star is not. So therefore, they don't cancel each other out anymore. Okay, so the message is, if you want to study fields that couple to electromagnetism, they better be complex valued fields. Otherwise, they don't couple. Okay, so let's take this action now and differentiate with respect to psi to get the equations of motion for the psi field. And let's differentiate with respect to A. Remember, the F really depends on the A. Differentiate with respect to the A to get the equations of motion of electromagnetism. And so we will get two sets of equations of motion, and we will see that they are coupled to each other, which is to say that the differential equations imply that the dynamics of the electromagnetic field influences and is influenced by the dynamics of the psi field. This will be very similar to what we will do later. Later, we will also have two kinds of dynamical fields around. One is matter fields, let's say inflaton field and so on, and the other one will be gravity. And then again, we will do a variation with respect to the matter fields, like psi, get an equation of motion for them. And we will also do a variation with respect to the metric, or the affine connection. And then we will get the equations of motion for gravity, which is the Einstein equation. And then we will again have two sets of equations. One is the Einstein equation. One is the equation for the matter field, like the Klein-Gordon equation or the electromagnetic Maxwell equations. And they will be coupled to each other. So here it's just electromagnetism coupled to scalar fields. But in general, it will be gravity coupled to all of the matter fields. And we could get the Einstein equation right now and right here if we just differentiate with respect to the g's, with respect to the degrees of freedom of curvature, get almost the Einstein equation, but not completely, because we haven't written down a dynamic term for gravity itself yet. These are only the, this is only the Lagrangian for the scalar field and for the electromagnetic field. We don't have a term in the Lagrangian yet that is purely for gravity, that describes its evolution on its own. These terms describe how everything interacts with gravity, because the G is everywhere in there. It's in the covariant derivatives. It's in the way you contract with the metric tensor, right? It's even in the measure of the action, the square root of G. It's everywhere. But we also need a term that describes the free evolution of gravity, and we haven't done that yet. All right, so we vary now with respect to psi to get the first equation of motion, and that's what we get. Again, please verify that if you do the functional derivative with respect to the psi star with the semicolon and the derivative with respect to the psi, plug it into the Euler Lagrange equation, the abstract one that we had above, namely this one. If you plug it in here, the equations of motion that you get, the equation of motion that you get for the psi field is this one. Let us quickly check what this is about. Second covariant derivative of psi contracted with the AB indices. If you remember, this is the Laplacian. Second covariant derivative summed over all coefficients of psi. If this was a Minkowski space, this would be an eta AB. And so it's just the, you know, second time derivative minus first derivative, second first derivative, first, second x derivative, second y derivative, second z derivative, right? This is the mass term. And here we have an interaction term. All of these are interaction terms that couple whatever the psi does to whatever values the A has. Okay. If now we take the action or the Lagrangian and we functionally differentiate to get the Euler Lagrange equations, and we plug the functional derivative with respect to A into the Euler Lagrange equation, what we get is these equations for the electromagnetic field. And what we find is that these are the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations as we had them earlier for the free Maxwell theory, that only that we have, of course, I mean, not only, but again, we have the semicolon here, the covariant derivative. And then I said that, okay, if there are no charges and currents, this stuff is equal to zero. But in our case now, we do have charges and currents, because this matter field psi is charged. It's a complex scalar field, so it has charge, just like a pi minus or pi plus particle field. And those charges and currents are here. So we can actually identify this thing here, those terms here, as the currents and charge four vector that is generated by complex valued scalar field. So what we see is that the electromagnetic field is affected by what psi does, just like psi was affected by what A does. So in order to find out how what the interplay is between the electromagnetic field and the psi field, when both are allowed freely to vary, you have to solve both partial differential equations at once, which is in general a tough order, but easy compared to what we face when we do that with gravity. Okay. Now, the Dirac equation. Can't avoid that. Half of the particles we know of are fermions. We have only time to do the basic, just to give you the gist of it, how you go about doing this. In special relativity, remember, the Dirac equation looks like this, where we have those famous gamma matrices here. The psi, the matter field for fermions, is a four-component vector field. And it's, however, neither a contravariant nor a covariant vector. It's some other thing, which is called a spinner field. And we will slowly get to what exactly it is in differential geometric terms. These gamma matrices are chosen very wisely by Dirac, namely in such a way that they have this anti-commutator. Gamma mu, gamma nu plus the other way around is equal to 2 times the eta matrices, which is the metric of special relativity. It turns out that you can't fulfill these anti-commutation relations in dimensions less than 4. So you have to have at least 4 by 4 matrices, but for 4 by 4 matrices, you can do it. So you find some matrices that do the trick. Find some 4 by 4 matrices that obey these anti-commutation relations, and then you can write down the Dirac equation. If you change your mind and you choose other Gamma matrices, you can also write down the Dirac equation, and it will differ from the previously studied Dirac equation by a change of bases in the Dirac spinor space. Just change bases, and that will change your Gamma matrices there. They are equivalent up to choice of bases. Now, why would we do that? Or why did Dirac do that? Why did Dirac insist that there would be Gamma matrices and that they would have these commutation relations? Historically, Dirac wanted a differential equation that describes the evolution of matter, which is only first order in time, only first derivatives in time. But then he had to contract with something. Okay, if you have 2 derivatives, you can just contract them with each other. But if there's only 1 derivative, if there are only first derivatives, in order to get something scalar, you have to contract it with something, and so he just called it gamma. Now, why would he want something first order? Well, he wanted something first order because if you have second order in time, then if you Fourier transform, you have E squared, which means that for every positive energy, you have a solution that's negative energy. And that meant that the Hamiltonian of your theory would not be bounded from below. It would behave the same way upwards in energy as downwards in energy. And Dirac thought that's a disaster. That cannot go right. Because if you have a Hamiltonian that's not bounded from below, you could always, you know, lower your energy while, by energy conservation, taking energy away. So you would have an infinite source of energy. How convenient, but not realistic that we would have that. So he conjectured we must have an equation of motion that's first order in time. But if it's first order in time, it's got to be first order in space too, for covariance. And then he got stuck with his gamma matrices. His arguing was totally wrong anyway. It turned out later that you can perfectly have second order stuff, like in the Klein-Gordon equation, like in the Maxwell equations, and so on. And the resolution to the puzzle is that, yes, you do get stuff of negative energy. But when you solve the equations of motion in quantum field theory, you are allowed to choose the propagator, the boundary conditions for your propagator, such that the negative energy solutions don't propagate forward in time, but backward in time. And then they are antiparticles. They behave as if they had positive energy, but propagated forward in time. But Dirac didn't know that yet. In any case, he had the right instinct to consider first order equations. But in order to make it work, he had to take these gamma matrices and make them solve certain conditions to make the Dirac equation work out nicely. So his reasoning was this. He said, the Klein-Gordon equation we know is covariant. This thing, we don't know if it's covariant, right? Because in principle, the gammas, if you just choose anything for the gamma, how is that going to be covariant? Okay, so he wanted to make sure that the whole thing is covariant. And what better way to ensure covariance than requiring that each component of the psi solves the Klein-Gordon equation? So that's what he wanted. And he said, okay, let's say that our psi obeys the Dirac equation. He didn't call it the Dirac equation, I guess. So here you have the Dirac equation, right? So this piece is equal to 0. And then he said, well, okay, if this is equal to 0, then whatever I multiply over here will still keep it 0. So he chose to write down pretty much the same thing again, but with a minus sign over here. It doesn't hurt. If psi solves the Dirac equation, then that whole thing, I mean, if this applied to psi is equal to 0, then the whole thing applied to psi is equal to 0. But when you spell that out, you get a lot of terms. Well, 4 terms, right? You get terms with gamma, gamma, and two derivatives, and then you get mixed terms which have only one set of gammas in it, and then you get the mass squared term. Now those mixed terms go away, and because we chose the sign here opposite from that sign, mixed terms go away, and the gamma-gamma terms look like this. And if we interchange two partial derivatives, we find it's the same thing, right? So that's symmetric. Now, if the gamma mu's and the gamma nu's have a product which is anti-symmetric or which has an anti-symmetric part in it, it doesn't matter. It drops out in this equation because this is symmetric. Symmetric contracted with something anti-symmetric would be zero. So we only need to care about the symmetric part in here. If we now spell out what the symmetric part is, it's 1/2 of gamma mu gamma nu plus gamma nu gamma mu. That's the symmetric part of this product. And if we apply that now, if we just write out what this is, then what Dirac said is that, okay, if the Dirac equation is fulfilled, then all of this will be fulfilled. And if now his famous condition on the gammas holds, so this thing, this is where this condition comes from, he said, if the Dirac equation holds, then all of this holds up to here. And if now he makes the additional requirement that the gammas are chosen such that this anti-commutator is the eta matrix eta mu nu times the identity in the 4x4 matrix of spinners, if he chooses it in this way, then what we get is the ordinary Klein-Gordon equation for each component of psi. If this thing just collapses to something diagonal in the space of four-component spinners, so it's just proportional to the identity matrix in the four-dimensional space of spinners, and other than that, it has the eta mu nu coefficients, then we simply have identity matrix acting on the four-component of spinners, and for each component, we have this thing here, second spatial derivative. That's the Laplace operator, or the D'Alembert operator, and that's just m squared for each component. So then everything would be fine. We know that the individual components of psi obey the Klein-Gordon equation as a matter of a consequence. So really, he has a first-order differential equation. But it is guaranteed simply by algebraic properties of the gammas that each component actually obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. So now in general relativity, it would seem that this is something we would want, but cannot do. You see, how do we do that in general relativity? How do we choose? Oh, are we locked in now? How do we choose? What? Okay. What's the cleaning personnel? Okay, so you see, in general relativity, we might think, okay, we just put a G menu in here. Bad idea, because it would mean that at every point in space and time, we have to choose other gamma matrices, right? That would be really tedious. We don't want to do that. So instead, what we can do is, in general relativity, is to choose our bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces at every point cleverly, so that the metric tensor is just the eta mu nu. Remember, we can do that. We can always choose bases in the tangent space such that the metric tensor takes that form. And then we're in business here. So in general relativity, we choose an orthonormal tetrad of basis vectors in each tangent space, the theta I, in such a way that with respect to this basis, the metric tensor takes that form. Eta mu nu everywhere. And then it suffices to choose one set of gamma matrices that obey that to write down the Dirac equation. Namely, we simply write down the Dirac equation in this way. It's I times the gamma matrices, and then the ordinary derivative is replaced with the covariant derivative, minus m times the Dirac spin is equal to 0. Well, if only it was so easy. It's not that easy, because what is this? How does this thing act on the psi? The psi is not a tangent vector or a cotangent vector. What is the covariant derivative in the e mu direction of a spinner? We haven't defined it yet. So our Dirac equation is already good. We can live with that. This is going to be basically the right way, but we still haven't defined that. So what we need to still find out is, how is a spinner parallel transported? What is its affine connection? And then we can define the Dirac equation. The key to doing that is to remember that the covariant derivative of a vector field gives us an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Right? This is what the Christoffel symbols really do. One index is contracted with the direction in which you want the parallel transport, then you're left with two indices, and those two remaining indices, one upper, one lower index, give us an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, an infinitesimal rotation, as you parallel transport. So the idea then is that the covariant derivative of a spinner field should give us the rotation of the spinner as we do an infinitesimal parallel transport of it. And it should be the infinitesimal rotation of the spinner according to that Lorentz transformation. So as you parallel transport some vector field, it will have a little bit of a rotation because of the Lorentz transformation. And that Lorentz transformation will also be the Lorentz transformation that rotates our spinner. But then we have to ask, how is a spinner Lorentz transformed? This is going back to special relativity. In special relativity, if you have a spinner field, four-component vector field, what happens if you change coordinate system? Just by changing from one Minkowski coordinate system to another one, just from one inertial to another one, just a Lorentz transformation. How do spinners transform under Lorentz transformation? This is what we need to find out. Once we know that, and especially once we know how infinitesimal Lorentz transformations work for spinners, then we can apply that for our spinners and then have the affine connection. And once we have the affine connection for spinners, we can, the so-called spin connection, once we have that, we can write down the Dirac equation. Okay, so the infinitesimal parallel transport of a vector, not a spinner yet, but a vector in the direction of another vector e mu is given in this way. So we have a vector, and that's mapped into itself plus, and that is the infinitesimal parallel transport of the vector e rho in the direction of e mu. I should really have a tiny little epsilon here in front to say that it's infinitesimal, but let's just drop that for the moment. And remember that the covariant derivative of a vector in the direction of another vector was given by the connection one form. So, which is really just another way of writing the Christoffel symbol, right? The Christoffel symbol with indices sigma, rho, mu is just that expression here, okay? So the curvature one form is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation valued one form. If I plug in here the direction in which I want to parallel transport, then those two indices give me a matrix, which is an infinitesimal rotation in space and time, an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, which we may call capital lambda sigma rho, just because Lorentz transformations are often denoted by the letter capital lambda. So as we parallel transport a vector, it will undergo a Lorentz transformation from the vector E rho into capital lambda sigma rho. And this should be a sigma here, sorry. Okay. Now this is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Therefore, we can expand it. It is a Kronecker delta to start with, because to lowest order, to zeroth order, the vector doesn't transform at all. So we have a Kronecker delta here, plus what the connection one form does. It's this matrix of small of an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Now it turns out that when you lower that index here, it will be antisymmetric. And that is the defining property for infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. This really goes into special relativity. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with this. You probably know that from rotations. If you take a finite rotation, you've probably seen in quantum mechanics that it can be generated by an infinitesimal rotation matrix, which is the angular momentum operator. The angular momentum is the generator of rotations. And when you represent the angular momentum as a matrix, then it will have this anti-Hermitian property. I mean, it's Hermitian, but there's an I needed to make it the actual generator of rotations. And that property is encoded here for the Lorentz transformations, which are not rotations, but rotations in space and time. Anyway, the gist of this is the point I wanted to make here is that for fixed choice of direction in which we want to parallel transport, that is the matrix of infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So next thing is we need to find out how a spinner transforms in special relativity when we expose it to this small Lorentz transformation. Yep.
So you chose to use a tetrahedron as your coordinate system.
Mm-hmm.
So the covariant derivatives just become no order of things.
No, not really. No. You have to be careful there. If you choose a Riemann normal coordinate system, then at its origin, the covariant derivative is an ordinary derivative. That's a different story from choosing the basis such that the metric always becomes eta. Because you can't choose a Riemann normal coordinate system everywhere at once, except if it's a flat space. So it's not true that just by going to a basis in the tangent spaces such that the metric becomes the eta matrix. That therefore the covariant derivative becomes trivial. It doesn't. And the same with the affine connection. They're still completely general. Okay, so the strategy will be that the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that transforms vectors and tensors will also be used as the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that transforms spinners. Now, from special relativity, let's check in special relativity, how does the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation act on a spinner? So let's say the Si are four basis vectors in the space of spinners. So our spinner can be written as a linear combination of some coefficient functions times these bases in the space of spinners. Then how do those basis vectors transform under a Lorentz transformation? So ultimately, we need to know what is the parallel transport, the affine connection, the covariant derivative of one of those basis vectors in the space of spinners when you parallel transport it in the direction of some direction vector EI. Once we can do that, we can write down the Dirac equation. We need the affine connection on spinners. And if we know how it acts on the basis vectors, we're done, because then with the coefficients in front, coefficient functions are just scalar functions. We can use the Leibniz rule to work with that. What we really need to know is how basis vectors get parallel transported under the affine connection. So from special relativity, it is known that when we do an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, so this is the Lorentz transformation, it's infinitesimal because it starts out with a Kronecker delta, and then we take one other term. Under these Lorentz transformations, vectors transform in this way. E mu goes into E mu plus, and then we have here the affine connection evaluated in the direction of wherever we sorry, this would be the affine connection in our case, but this is just very general. Any small Lorentz transformation can be written in this form. And in particular, if you apply it to a vector, that's how it will transform. In our case, this will arise from an affine connection, but it doesn't have to for this argument. Then, special relativity tells us that a Dirac spinner transforms in this way. If this Si is a basis vector in the space of spinners, then it goes into itself under small Lorentz transformation plus this stuff. You may wonder, where does that come from? So here's a whole box about where this comes from, as you can read at your own time. But let me give you the gist of it. The commutator of gamma matrices is playing the role of angular momentum operators for rotation. If you take an angular momentum operator and you exponentiate it, or I times the angular momentum operator exponentiated, you get a rotation, right? E to the power alpha I L3 is a rotation around the three axis by the angle alpha. If you exponentiate that thing with an I alpha, you're rotating a spinner by the angle alpha. It just so turns out that those guys have the same commutation relations as do the angular momentum operators. In fact, more than just the angular momentum operators, also the boosts for special relativity. These things have four indices there. So you can generate rotations in space and time using those things. To verify that that's the case, just find out what the commutator is between one of those commutators and another one of those commutators. You can work that out because you know what the anti-commutator is. And you will verify that they obey this algebra that's necessary for rotations. In other words, these guys are the generators of infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, because Lorentz transformations are the rotations in space and time. So these are the generators of Lorentz transformations on spinner space, also with a factor of 1/4 built into it. And therefore, and that's just the result from special relativity that would take a little too long to derive from scratch. When in special relativity we Lorentz transform a basis vector in the space of spinners, it goes into the same basis vector minus, and this is the these are the coefficients of the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, this thing, times those generators here. And then this whole thing is, of course, a 4x4 matrix, because the gammas are 4x4 matrices. So this whole thing is a 4x4 matrix, and it's contracted with these things. The whole thing is a 4x4 matrix. And that 4x4 matrix is transforming that 4 vector S. OK, so we use this result from special relativity. This is the key thing. It tells us how spinners transform under an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So an affine connection should do just that. An affine connection should take a spinner basis vector and map it into itself. I mean, the affine connection gives us the change of the spinner. So it gives us this piece here, where that is the Lorentz transformation that comes from the usual affine connection, the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. All right, so we apply that to GR. And so if a vector E mu is infinitesimally parallel transported in the direction of a direction vector EA, then it acquires an infinitesimal rotation, namely the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that is given in this way, affine connection, plug in the direction in which you parallel transport, and you get out the coefficients of an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. That is the value of the connection one form. As we said, this is how a vector transforms. But now, we can also read off, I'm sorry, this is just the same thing again. See, from, it's a bit repetitive, but let me just spell it out. So we under an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, a vector transforms this way, which is to say that the affine connection produces this piece. Right? So this is the piece that is produced by the affine connection. It's a change of a vector under parallel transport. Now, when a spinner Si is infinitesimal parallel transported in the direction of a vector Ea, then its two experiences an infinitesimal rotation. Its rotation, it's generated by this infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. And from special relativity, we know that to the spinners, it does that. And we can read off again that therefore, the affine connection applied to a spinner basis vector must give us that piece. Just like over here, we said that this is how a vector transforms. Therefore, the affine connection gives us this piece, the thing on the right. Here we have that a spinner transforms like this under parallel transport. So this is the output of the affine connection. So we have that this equation must be that equation. And this is the big unknown. This is the thing that we wanted to determine. Now we can simply match that with this up here. So we obtain that the covariant derivative of a basis vector in the spinner space in the direction of a tangent vector is given by all of this business here, where this is the usual affine connection coefficient in the direction in which we want to parallel transport. So that is just a matrix, 4x4 matrix, just to be contracted with this. And the whole thing is a 4x4 matrix. A 4x4 matrix that acts on that basis vector here and gives us a linear combination of basis vectors. And that is what happens to a single basis vector in the space of spinners. Okay, now that we know how to parallel transport a basis vector in the space of spinners, we can also calculate how to parallel transport an arbitrary spinner. Namely, the parallel transport or affine connection or covariant derivative of an arbitrary spinner in the direction Ea is then the covariant derivative of an arbitrary spinner is a linear combination of the basis vectors in the spinner space with the coefficients just being some coefficient functions. Remember that the psi I of x are not spinners. This is just scalar functions. These are the spinners, the basis vectors in the spinner space. So these are just scalar coefficient functions. And the covariant derivative acting on a fully general spinner will therefore give us two contributions. One contribution from when the covariant derivative acts on that, which is really just the action of a covariant derivative on a function, which is the ordinary derivative on a function, leaving this alone. And another term where we leave that alone and we have the covariant derivative act on these, but we know what that is. This gives us that business over here. So to spell out the two terms, we have one term where we have the covariant derivative acting on the functions, leaving the spinner basis alone, and then another term where we leave the coefficient functions alone and we have that. By spelling it all out, we obtain that the covariant derivative on psi is given by the covariant derivative acting on the coefficient functions. But what is that? It's the directional derivative of psi in the direction of Ea, which is the partial derivative in the Ea direction, which is Ea as a tangent vector applied to a scalar function. So it's just that. And then minus, I'm dropping indices here just to keep things a little simpler, and then minus this term here, where you know, the psi I of x, I just dropped that index I and the dependence on x here, otherwise the formula would be very long. So we have also this term here, the psi, and then the covariant derivative of the basis of the spinner space is given by this. That's over here. So finally, we know how to covariantly differentiate a spinner. And so we can write down the Dirac equation now. So the general relativistic Dirac equation then takes this form. We had it earlier, except now we know how to evaluate this thing by the formula above. So explicitly, if we spell it out, we get here the gamma mu's, and then we get the covariant derivative acting on psi which produces two terms, if you remember. One where we have the derivative acting on the psi, that's this term, and another term where we have the, remember, one derivative where we have the ordinary derivative on psi, and then the other term which has all these commutators of the gamma matrices. That's over here, and then the mass term too. All right, so now you might think, that's a little tedious. Shouldn't it be easier to do that? Isn't there a simpler way to do this, something algebraic, where we don't have to go through all that tedious business? There is. There is a way to do it, but it would require quite a bit of machinery. You do have the basics for it, but it would take us too long to go through the abstract way. But let me just illustrate the essence of it. Remember what Dirac's main point was. He wanted a first-order differential equation such that the square of it is the Laplacian, or the square of it is the D'Alembertian. Now let's look at what the D'Alembertian is. You remember the abstract definition of the D'Alembertian on differential forms? Remember how that went? It's the d del plus del d. Okay, so the d is the exterior derivative, and the del is the co-derivative. Right? The d is the exterior derivative. It turns the p form into a p plus 1 form. The co-derivative turns the p form into a p minus 1 form. It uses the Hodge star and all that stuff, right? And then we said that d del plus del d is a self-adjoint operator, etc., etc. What would be the square root of that? What's the square root of d del plus del d? In principle, it's easy. In principle, it's easy. It's just d plus del. Okay? Let's square that. I mean, maybe that's the Dirac operator. Just square this thing. What do we get? We get a d squared, goes away. We get a del squared, also goes away. And we get two mixed terms, a d del plus a del d. Okay, so if you just square that, that would be the D'Alembert operator. So what's the problem with this? Why didn't we do that from the beginning? You see, this thing is not mapping p-forms into p-forms, because the d is mapping p-forms into p plus 1 forms, that is mapping p-forms into p minus 1 forms. So what we see here is that this thing is mixing up all the differential forms. And now we see also that when we look at the Dirac operator from this perspective, then yes, it is sort of inside the algebra of the differential forms. But it's not easy. Right? It's not easy because it's mapping all of them into all of them. And so indeed, in order to make these things precise, in order to identify the spinners as being tensors, as being combinations of tensors, or as being combinations of differential forms, what we need to do is generalize the definition of the Grassmann algebra that we had earlier. Remember, the Grassmann algebra was the algebra of differential forms with the wedge product. Okay? Take the wedge product of two differential forms, you get a differential form again, etc. It turns out there's a generalization of Grassmann algebras, and therefore of the algebra of differential forms. It's a generalization of it, such that we can then nicely identify what the spinners are in there. And the action of the Dirac operators will be smooth in there. And that deformation, or that generalization of the Grassmann algebra, is called the Clifford algebra. And I invite you to look these things up in more detail. But you see that, in principle, it would be possible to do all those things more abstractly and, in a sense, more cleanly. But it would be even more effort to do that. And I didn't want to focus on fermions so much, because we want to finally get to gravity now. Right? So we just spent half an hour on half a lecture on the Dirac equation, when really there is so much more interesting to be said about it. Okay, so that's that. And then from now on, only GR. See you next week. And in the meantime, as I said, I will send you all an email with instructions about the essay and project and so on.